It's just past 8:30 in the morning, and you're listening to Upfront. I'm Antonia Juhas. Martha Nussbaum is a professor of law and ethics at the University of Chicago. In 2016, she was awarded the Kyoto Prize in Arts and Philosophy, regarded as the most prestigious award available in fields not eligible for Nobel. She's written more than 22 books, including Upheavals of Thought, The Intelligence of Emotions, and Not-for-Profit, Why Democracy Needs the Humanities. Her most recent book is The Monarchy of Fear, A Philosopher Looks at Our Political Crisis, just released from Simon & Schuster, and she joins us today. Thanks for being with us, Professor Nussbaum.
Oh, thank you very much, Antonia. I'm very much looking forward to being on the West Coast and giving a talk tonight and meeting a lot of you, I hope.
Yeah, so in addition to joining us for the next half hour to discuss her book, as Professor Nussbaum just said, she is speaking here tonight in Berkeley at 7:30 p.m. at St. John's Presbyterian Church, 2727 College Avenue. The talk is a benefit for KPFA. Advance tickets are $12 or $15 at the door, and you can learn more at kpfa.org. But stay tuned, because we'll also be giving away two pairs of free tickets at the end of this half hour. So thanks again for being with us, and we're going to dive right in to your new book. And this is such an important book. It was such a joy and pleasure to read it, I have to say. So thank you
The book. That's very nice.
So the first page of the introduction to The Monarchy of Fear, you write, "There's a lot of fear around the U.S. today, and this fear is often mingled with anger, blame, and envy. Fear all too often blocks rational deliberation, poisons hope, and impedes constructive cooperation for a better future." So let's start there. Why did you write a book about fear?
Well, this is part of what I've done all my career. That is one of the main things I've tried to do as a philosopher, is go back to the study of the human emotions. But I had not focused on fear. And the election itself made me notice my own fear and the way my fear kind of derailed me and made me have a hard time thinking straight about things. And what I noticed was that although I'd written books on emotions one by one, like a book on anger and another book on disgust, fear is kind of simmering behind them all. And it infects, and I would say pollutes them all, making anger more strident, more apt to search for scapegoats and people to blame for our problems. And it contributes very powerfully to the polarization that I think we experience in this political moment, that troubles me a lot as a citizen, but also as a teacher. I've got students who have a hard time talking to each other and so on. So that's really why I wrote this book, to say, in a way, mea culpa. I had been wrong not to emphasize fear enough in the other books that I'd written about emotions. And now I wanted to investigate how that changed my own ideas about anger and disgust and envy, but also to really turn the laser beam on our current political moment and see how fear is operating there.
Well, you also start, which is very helpful for a book interviewer, the book begins using the Socratic method. So you have a question, an imaginary questioner, the defender of fear, who asks you questions to which you respond. And what I felt was particularly interesting there was really helping us understand why the title, The Monarchy of Fear, and the relationship of fear to being a particular threat to democracy.
Yeah, well, first of all, the method. I do always think that listening to the skeptical questions of my colleagues and my students is one of the best ways to start thinking well. And I think this is something that we should all be doing more, is examining ourselves partly through talking to each other. So that voice is partly Socratic, partly it's my co-author Saul Levmore is in there someplace, because he's often asking me skeptical questions. But what I wanted to say was that, you know, as babies, we begin in a state of extreme physical powerlessness and extreme dependence on others while we're quite aware of what's going on. Babies are highly intelligent, but they are so powerless. So that's a funny combination. You don't get that in any other species. And it sets the agenda for a lot of problems in life, because babies are physically powerless, they cannot get what they want. They can't move to get it the way a young dog could do pretty quickly. And so they have to command other people. They have to be monarchs. Freud called the baby his majesty, the baby. And what Freud meant by this is, you know, you've got to be all powerful, because otherwise you won't get what you want. And then the other side of that is you're also completely dependent on some powerful monarch, namely the parent, who's got to give you what you want. So it's the two sides to monarchy: complete dependency on an all-powerful character, and then you also have to become a monarch in order to order people around and get what you want. So all of that is quite inimical to democracy, which requires us to look each other in the eye as equals, trust each other, be reciprocal, and in some sense of love, loving toward each other. But you don't do that when you're a paralyzed and terrified little baby. And I think that it's sometimes in our lives we return to that situation of infancy, strange economic problems, all sorts of problems in life throw us back into the arms of our own childhood. An illness can do that, a divorce can do that. And in those moments, it's very hard for us to be good democratic citizens and trusting and loving and reciprocal. So I was talking about democracy as a mature stage in the personality that requires us to go beyond the narcissism of infantile fear. And unfortunately, you know, the world is full of obstacles and life is full of reversals, and we don't always stay in that moment. And I think right now in America, there are a lot of very difficult problems that are making people revert to this kind of infantile fear, where we want an all-powerful father to take care of us, and we also want to blame things on other people and demonize other people, rather than to say, let's sit down and let's look each other in the eye, let's sort things out and figure out the solution together.
And so, I mean, part of what you're saying then is, by being afraid of Donald Trump, by being afraid of his policies, by being afraid of his followers and those that are backing him and supporting him and funding him, by having fear guide our reaction to them, we're actually empowering them?
Well, okay, let's take it from different points of view. I think Trump is amazingly clever at appealing to this needy fear that says, oh, trust in the all-powerful Donald and you'll be fine. And his followers partly feel that, but then that partly they get into the fear blame syndrome, where feeling helpless, they want to blame someone else and say, well, if we can keep the immigrants out or build a big wall, then we can be okay. The other side, though, I think you're right. I mean, so people on the left also get co-opted by fear and want to just blame villains instead of trying to figure out how together we can solve our problems. In the book, I talk a lot about Martin Luther King Jr. and about how he saw the great danger in demonizing and making a villain of the other side, because it gave rise to a feeling that we must destroy the opposition, we must have a lot of blame and violence, rather than what he tried to urge people to have, an attitude of faith and hope and love. And then, of course, he immediately says, I don't mean you have to like the people, but you have to love them in the sense of having goodwill and trying to solve our common problems together. So that's what I'm really calling for, and very much influenced by King, who I think was a great, great philosopher, as well as being a wonderful and courageous political leader. But anyway, that's where we are. And I think both the left and the right are in the arms of fear and blame and unable to talk together.
Our guest is Martha Nussbaum. She's professor of law and ethics at the University of Chicago, and we're discussing her most recent book, The Monarchy of Fear, A Philosopher Looks at Our Political Crisis. She'll be speaking tonight in Berkeley about her book as well at 7:30 tonight at St. John's Presbyterian Church. More information on that at kpfa.org. And you say, in fact, that even in spite of extreme economic inequality, the going backwards of the Trump administration in policies towards economic equality and social equality and justice, you still find a reason to overcome that fear and the subsequent anger, envy, and other attendant emotions to find hope, and to find hope in work. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, look, we are a federal nation. A lot of the most important things for inequality, such as the criminal justice system, where such a large number of African Americans have been incarcerated in this country, but that's a state matter. It's a matter of state law and state implementation for the most part. And so, you know, we have power as citizens wherever we are. Never mind what the federal government is doing, we have a lot of power. And so to blame it all on Trump and to say, well, because Trump is there, therefore I'm going to drop out and despair and I have no power, that is a recipe for disaster. In terms of economic issues, one of the big problems that we face is the changing nature of employment, automation, technological change. And so it's the question, how can we train people who can get the jobs that there are, which increasingly require a college education? Well, that's, again, an issue that we can all do quite a lot about, because it's an issue of the high cost of university education. So what can we all do? Well, we're in different positions. As a faculty member of a private university, I can work quite hard to raise money for fellowships for people who otherwise wouldn't afford it. But states can do quite a lot to lower the cost of higher education. So we can campaign for that at the state level. The federal government has actually relatively little power over the cost of higher education. So one of the things that gives me hope is that I see tremendous upsurge in political involvement all over this country with the midterm elections coming. I've never seen people so knowledgeable and so informed about where are their contested congressional seats. Seats are contested that were not contested. I'm just now involved in two congressional campaigns in the neighborhood of Chicago where there are incumbents who are newly vulnerable. And, you know, people are joining in and new people getting involved, young people, and these candidates themselves are new people who were just not in politics before. One of them is a clean energy entrepreneur. He was doing good stuff with his clean energy company, but to run for Congress is a step further, and I'm just delighted that he's doing that. Another one is a woman who was a professor of nursing. Well, she's decided, I'm going to throw my hat into the ring and run for political office, and she's doing a great, great job. So I think I'm very, very happy with what I see in the political process in the run-up to the 2018 elections.
What do you say to people who say, you know, given the stakes of what is going wrong right now, is it really meaningful to say that a couple of people running for Congress and a couple of protest marches against gun control is really going to be able to do anything? How is that enough in the face of what we're facing? And then that brings people back to, you know, we really can't have any impact on how bad things are.
Well, I think we're all situated in some local context, and we always can influence the local context. And look, as I just said, a lot of issues are state level issues. So just even getting a better state legislature is a big deal, because the policies about higher education are set by the state legislature and, of course, the governor. We are, I think, soon to elect a much better governor than the one we've had in previous years. I say this with a little bit of confidence when I just saw that he's 18 points up in the polls today. And this is, you know, defeating someone who left us with not a cent, who wouldn't sign any budget because he didn't like the people who controlled the state legislature. So for 2 years, we had no budget. So just rising up and defeating that kind of naysaying politics, which hurt people terribly to have no money flowing into mental health programs, community programs, and all of this with just malice and spite as his main political arsenal. So, you know, to get rid of that, it gives me great hope. And I think people can only live where they are. There's something that each one of us can do wherever we are, whether we're educators, whether we're parents, are terribly important because you can always influence the next generation. And that's, again, one of the most powerful roles that any human being can play. But at the same time, just yes, to work for a congressional candidate. You know how narrowly divided the Congress is now, and it is within the power of everyone to change the direction of politics. So I do believe that everyone has power, and you just have to figure out where you are, what your power is, and what you are the best person to do, and then you can just do that.
And the last thing I'm going to touch on is, you know, talking about everyone has their own power and their own ability to act, you also have a section in the book on sexism and misogyny and the need to overcome those twin forces to help more people embrace their power. Can you talk a little about that
before wrap up? Well, first let me talk about those two words. Mm-hmm. I mean, the way I use them, and of course it's not, you know, you just have to stipulate that I'm going to use them in a certain way, which might not be ordinary language. Sexism is a set of beliefs in female inferiority, and misogyny, I'm drawing on a very important book by the young philosopher Kate Mann. Misogyny is an enforcement mechanism that doesn't necessarily rest on sexist beliefs. In fact, the more powerful you believe women are, the more determined you might be to keep them in their place. So I think it's the latter that's the bigger problem. And I think by now, sexism as such, that is the view that women can't do X and Y and Z, has so long been refuted that no one could defend it with a straight face. But the determination to keep women down is therefore all the more powerful because men see that women who used to be props, support structure for male careers, are just not doing that anymore. Women are doing their own thing. And that makes people furious because not only are women taking their jobs, but they're also not at home supporting them. And so there's a lot of anger there. There's a lot of blame of women. There's also, I think, envy, because envy is the emotion you feel when some other group monopolizes the good things in life and you feel you can't get them and you feel powerless. And I do think the increasing success of women in higher education, all over the world, by the way. I mean, not just in the U.S. by any means. The University of Amman in Jordan, 75% of the entering students in that prestigious university are women. So, you know, it's a worldwide phenomenon that women just do very, very well in tests and other things. And this makes people crazy. What's going to happen to me? You know, and then all the acting out that we saw in the campaign, which used tropes of the disgusting female body. Oh, here's Hillary going to the bathroom. Isn't that disgusting? Mm-hmm. That feeds on a base out there who really are furious and are driven kind of crazy by women's prominence, women's success, and then they act out in this childish way. Well, what's the remedy for that? Well, of course, I think it's got to be ultimately bringing up men in the next generation who don't need women to be staying at home as a support structure, who are willing to be equals and cooperate and so on. But in the meantime, women just get out there and run for office. And this is happening all over the country. Women are showing their appeal, their power, their willingness to address the real issues, their ability to connect with both male and female voters. And I think this is gradually bringing about a real revolution in our politics.
Sorry, just one thing to sort of push on, which is, you know, it's not just men being angry at women. It's not just men still trying to hold on to their power. It's extreme actions and policies that are enforcing this misogyny and sexism. So seeing the president of the United States and combining these forces of hate, forces of hate against immigrants and forces of hate against women in particular, I think coming to the fore in the family separation policy. Of course, men were also separated from children, but the majority was women being separated from their children at the border. To me, this is the full embodiment of a hate-filled policy leading to, torturous outcomes. And how we, stand against that embodiment of this fear that you're writing about.
Well, I couldn't agree more. I think just manifesting, yes, as has happened, that this is a hateful policy, that we can't stand to have that assault on family, love and connection. I mean, there has been all over the country an uprising against this. It's been quite daunting, even for the people who put that in place, so that they've backtracked a little bit too late because they haven't been able to reunite the families. But anyway, yes, I mean, I think we have to say we won't tolerate that. But I think that, it has a lot of small aspects. It, like here in the law school, it's a very male world. It's configured as a male world, but just to manifest that a faculty member who's male can ask for paternity leave. I have a colleague who actually, and perhaps not coincidentally, is a Muslim man who was the first in our law school to demand paternity leave. And he did it because his wife, who's a Jewish woman who's a trauma nurse, I mean, she had a pretty heavy schedule. So he needed to be a full-time parent. But, doing those little things. And then here's our senator from Illinois, Tammy Duckworth, who is not only one of the first people in the Senate with a major disability, but one of the first new mothers in the Senate, just saying, I'm going to bring my baby onto the floor of the Senate, and I'm going to maybe not breastfeed right there on the floor, but I'm going to breastfeed outside, and I want you to know that I want the baby to be around. These things are changing the world. Mm-hmm. I was just in New Zealand, where, as I'm sure you know, the prime minister gave birth a short time ago, and boy, that is a revolution. The head of state giving birth, and the partner, who's not even married, so that's another thing. The partner is the full-time parent, and she's going to insist on all kinds of facilities for breastfeeding and childcare in the center corridors of power. So I think these are the things that, in daily ways, without anger, but just with them manifesting the importance of love and connection, can change the world.
And that is so much of what is in the book. The book is entitled The Monarchy of Fear, A Philosopher Looks at Our Political Crisis. And so much of it is about overcoming that fear with hope and love and your feelings of hopefulness that we can, in fact, do this. So thank you so much for being with us today, Martha Nussbaum.
Oh, thank you so much, Antonia. And I hope that anyone who comes to the talk, I look forward to meeting you and signing books.
Yeah, there is so much more to talk about. So fortunately, our guest, Professor Martha Nussbaum, professor of law and ethics at the University of Chicago and author of the new book, The Monarchy of Fear, A Philosopher Looks at Our Political Crisis, is speaking tonight here in Berkeley. And you can come listen to her at 7:30 p.m. She'll be at St. John's Presbyterian Church, 2727 College Avenue. Her talk is a benefit for KPFA. Advance tickets are $12 or $15 at the door. You can learn more at kpfa.org. But as I said at the beginning, if you're listening right now, we have a special offer for you. We have two pairs of tickets to give away right now to callers number 3 and 7. If you call us at 510-848-4425, that's 510-848-4425.